morning, everyone.
Morning, Pat. Morning, guys.
Morning.
Pat, before we start, are you able to screen share? Do you see it?
What was that? Sorry, I gotta turn my volume up.
That was to me, right, Gina?
Yeah, it was you. It was to you, Pat.
Yeah, after last meeting's issues, I'm just gonna give it a whirl real fast. Can you guys see that?
Yeah, it worked.
Yep.
All right, great.
All right, thank you.
Was it the last meeting that it was? It was almost the hardest thing to do.
It was difficult, but it's all right. We got it set now.
Morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, we're good.
Thank you.
All right, it's 10 o'clock and we have a quorum. Bobby, are you good if I start? I don't hear Bobby. Hold on, let me go find her. See if there's something wrong. One second. Okay, she can hear us, we just can't hear her, so we're gonna proceed. All right, so I'd like to call the August 21st pension meeting to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the May 15th, 2025 minutes. You had received a copy of those minutes prior to this meeting. Is there any questions, comments, or concerns about those minutes? Okay, hearing none, they'll stand approved. The next item is public comment. Is there anybody online that would like to speak? Okay, we have nobody online. So we're going to close public comment. Next item is the performance reports of the pension and OPEB funds. And we have Mr. Pat Wing here from Marquette Associates, and he's going to go over those reports. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Gina. So we did a trial run of this. Hopefully it'll work in real time now. If you bear with me for a quick second, I'll share my screen here. Everybody can see that okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Great. So as Gina noted, we'll begin with the Q2 or the end of the fiscal year performance report here. And if you'll bear with me for a second, I will just skip ahead through the first few pages here and start where we always do as it relates to the market environment. Just a quick economic capital market overview to provide a little context for how and why both the pension and OPEB funds performed the way they did during the quarter. And as I wrap up this in a few minutes, going to spend a little bit more time at the end of the market environment talking about more of a structural outlook, if you will. And then when I wrap up later on, more of a short-term outlook as we begin to close out 2025 here in just a few months. But with that said, the U.S. economy did rebound in the second quarter. You can see in the chart here, the bars are the quarterly economic growth numbers. Here's Q2 compared to Q1. So a nice rebound from that marginally negative first quarter. And when we peel back the layers a little bit, a couple things worth mentioning. Number one, as we note here in the top bullet point, consumer spending was a key driver of that rebound. It did accelerate in Q2 compared to Q1. But then the other factor, and this was an issue in Q1 that we talked around, the distortions in the overall headline number, was net exports. Now, if you recall in Q1, net exports was a big detractor from economic growth. It detracted 5 percentage points as firms imported a ton of goods in anticipation of the tariff announcements in early April, so they're trying to front run the tariff implementation and build their inventories. And then once things were implemented in early April, despite the pauses and extensions, there were baselines that were put into effect, imports really fell notably. So in other words, net exports, what we export abroad less what we import at home, added 5 percentage points to GDP in Q2. So it pretty much was a wash now in the first half of the year. And as we move forward, hopefully we get a better sense of what, if any, the tariff impact is going to be from an inflation and economic perspective. Now, again, we've seen an impact from firms' decision-making in anticipation of them, but the actual data itself, whether it be economic activity or inflation, we haven't seen much to this point, and this point meaning at the end of June. Now, when we think about why that may be, the investment firm Carlyle put together some interesting analysis. And if we look to the chart to the right here on the bottom, showing essentially the front running from a data perspective, specifically how the inventories of firms' goods surge relative to year-ago levels. And you can see the surge beginning here, middle of Q1, late Q1, and plateauing at around 40% above year-ago levels. And this effectively allow firms to maintain their pricing and production schedules even in the wake of the tariffs being implemented, as they were effectively had huge inventories of these goods and were selling those goods as likely as we worked our way through the Q2 that were not subject to the tariffs yet. But as we ended in June or early July, they were just modestly above year ago levels. And as we sit here this morning, they're probably much lower now than year ago levels, because we know those imports, again, that I referenced a minute ago, really dropped off quite a bit. So as we move forward here, what's coming into the marketplace has likely been subject to some level of tariffs, depending on the sourcing of that good coming into the U.S. Now, what's also interesting about that is it does jive with some analysis that Morgan Stanley put out earlier this year, specifically saying that tariffs themselves likely won't impact inflation for maybe about 4 months after implementation, and then begin to impact economic growth about 8 months after that. So we're effectively there from an inflation perspective and economic activity perspective, maybe later this year. And it does make sense that it's a little bit of a lag. So in other words, prices maybe tick up a little bit, consumers then respond to those sorts of impact to their income growth, and then adjust spending, and then affect economic activity in the wake of that. But we are seeing more recently, if we think about inflation and specifically the labor market, as we think about the Fed, a little bit of it an impact more recently. So this is really post Q2 data, and specifically around some of the inflation reports we got last week. It did show some interesting things, specifically some goods prices that were more exposed to tariffs than other goods prices ticked up a little bit more. Still not anything of concern yet. But what was interesting about the inflation data was that the services side of the economy, which, should be in theory immune to tariffs, and I'm not implying that tariffs played any role in this. It's just interesting that we saw pricing pressures pick up on the services side of the equation. And as we think about what does this mean for the Fed, and then likely interest rates and fixed income and any other second order effects across markets, they remain in this catch 22, right? Inflation's still 3-ish plus percent on a year-over-year basis, so not particularly close to their mandate. But what we saw from the labor market, and we have some data and text here on the June report, but when we think about the most recent July report, we saw jobs being posted about 73,000, which is a decent number. It was a little bit below expectations, but the big news, as I'm sure you all were aware of, was the downward revisions to the two previous months, totaling around 260,000 dollars, excuse me, jobs. And typically, when you see big revisions, it tends to happen at turning points. It's not a hard and fast rule, but history would suggest it's more often than not where if we had big positive revisions, that would be generally a good omen for the health of the labor market in the near term moving forward, and vice versa. So, thinking about this catch 22, again, inflation's obviously above the Fed target. The labor market, based on the recent report, is weakening at the margin. So their mandates are essentially providing this tension. And as we look out for the rest of this year, the Fed still has three meetings left. The next one's about 4 weeks in September. The market's pricing in about an 80% chance that they cut rates by 25 basis points. The market's pricing in over the remainder of this year, essentially two cuts. And the Fed's base case, at least as of June, was for two cuts. Now, before that meeting comes, we do get more inflation data, another jobs report, and those are going to be highly influential on not just market pricing of what the Fed may or may not do, but of what the Fed ultimately does itself. Now, as we think about these dynamics, again, a lot of the inflation comments I just made, the labor market comments I just made, were really post Q2. Whereas if we look at what markets did in Q2, they were pretty strong across the board. Now, important to note, early April, obviously, we had that sort of mini waterfall kind of decline in the wake of April 2nd. But once those tariffs were paused, markets found a bottom immediately and just ripped higher throughout the rest of the quarter. And you can see that within the equity markets here between US, developed non-US, emerging markets, all between 11, 12% for the quarter. Bonds here, not surprisingly, investment grade bonds up marginally. So rates jumped around during the quarter, but essentially ended where they began across most of the yield curve, leading the return just to be generated by the quarterly income investment grade bonds accrue and pay out. As far as bank loans, they were up 2.3%. Not terribly surprising that they were ahead of investment grade bonds in an environment where equities are up by double digits. So their relative performance certainly makes a lot of sense given the environment. As we think about some of the other asset classes in the two portfolios, real estate infrastructure, as we'll see here shortly, we're both up. Real estate around 1.5%, infrastructure around 2%. So pretty much all the asset classes within both funds posted positive gains, but obviously equities leading the way in a pretty strong market environment. Now, when we dig underneath the hood a little bit around what drove markets, the pattern remains of what we've seen over the past really 3 or 4 calendar years, meaning that what we've seen generally is when the market is gaining ground or moving higher, that it's generally in the large cap space, the sort of mega cap names, the tech names that are driving the bulk of the gains. And we can see that from a sector perspective here. Communication services, here's where your Alphabets, your Metas are housed, up almost 19%. Information technology, your Microsofts, your Nvidias, et cetera, up 24%. And then you also see these dynamics within the smaller and mid-cap part of the market. And to illustrate that, we've effectively put together a little bit of a comparison down here below, showing the growth of the broad market here, the Russell 3000, versus just an ETF of quantum computing and machine learning stocks. And again, when the market's moving higher, so it's more speculative names that are kind of driving things and outperforming. But when it moves lower, effectively seeing the opposite of that. The first half of the year illustrates this pretty well because Q1, as you all well know, in early April was a difficult environment. You could see this green line here of the more speculative, smaller mid-cap names in this ETF underperforming or finding a lower bottom than the broader market, but then ripping higher in the 2+ months in the wake of that bottom. So again, over the past 4 calendar years, this is effectively the pattern we've seen, which, as we'll see here shortly, was a little bit of a headwind from an equity perspective because, as I'm sure you all will recall, over the past however number of meetings, talking a lot about how we have exposure to some of these names, but we're underweight them compared to the broad market for really a multitude of reasons, one of which I'll illustrate as I wrap the market environment up here on the next pages, largely due to valuation concerns. So on this just bottom chart that I'll reference here, what we're showing for various U.S. equity market segments, here's the broad market, so I'll start here, is essentially the dashed line is the current price to earnings ratio of the market. And then the boxes effectively show the 20-year distribution of those monthly price to earnings ratios throughout that history. So the middle line here is effectively the median valuation over the past 20 years. And then you have what's called an interquartile range, effectively saying this is the 25th to the percentile to the median, and then the median to the 75th. Whereas, obviously, if the valuation's below the median, depending on the deviation or how far below, you can make a case that things are undervalued and vice versa for above, and which is effectively where we find ourselves. But what's interesting, once we break this broad market down a little bit, move over here to the left, this is where those mega cap AI, leaders are housed, right? The Nasdaq 100 trading at a multiple, call it about 36 at the end of June, compared to a median of about 26 over the past couple of years. And as you work your way from left to right, it's a similar story for the S&P here. A lot of these names comprise the bulk of this index. And then when you get to more mid and small cap stocks, things are generally a little bit more undervalued, or let me say, rephrase, reasonably valued. Now, when we think about these dynamics, this means little to nothing in the short term, meaning that valuations tend not to matter until they do, for lack of a better phrase, but it matters over the intermediate and long term. So, in other words, what's overvalued tends to underperform and vice versa. But at least in the short term here, this, markets generally don't seem to care about this again until they do. Now, some of the other reasons outside of the valuation dynamics where we're kind of underweight these names within the market is, when we typically see innovations like we're seeing right now as it relates to, artificial intelligence, if we go back to the tech boom of the late 90s, or, back even further to, airlines or railroads or however far back we want to go in the day. Typically, what you see from a market perspective is The producers.
This meeting is being transcribed and summarized.
The producers of the innovation typically are bid up by the market. But what ultimately happens is it's the consumers of the innovation that ultimately benefit, because a lot of new entrants come in, they see the potential for maybe outsized profits, and effectively there's an overinvestment cycle in particular areas, which ultimately brings down the return on that initial investment for the producers of that innovation, right? And then coupled with that, yeah, I was competing with China, and really any sector of the economy that China gets involved in, profits usually go way, way down, because they typically flood the market with cheap goods and services, effectively, you know, undercutting a lot of the competition. So it's those sort of more long-term structural reasons why we continue to be underweight these stocks. Again, the market's not going to care until it does, but that's what really gives us some pause. And we have exposure, but again, we're underweight due to, you know, these, say, you know, more intermediate and longer term concerns. But again, in the short term, the market's going to do what it does. So with that said, let me get into the pension and OPEB, and we'll cover the pension in more detail, touch quickly on the OPEB, because the takeaways will largely be the same. So the market value of the pension at the end of the fiscal year was $181.2 million. You can see up top there, the net investment change in the quarter was a little north of $11 million, which translated into a return of 6.7%. That was about 80 basis points behind the policy index benchmark, largely due to the equity dynamics I spoke to earlier, but I'll illustrate that here in a minute. But importantly, for the fiscal year, you can see the net investment gain there, but the return of 11.4%. Behind the policy, largely because of what just took place in Q2, but importantly, ahead of the assumed rate of return, which Chiron will give a more detailed overview about at our next meeting. And as far as the attribution, you know, what drove or what was helpful from a relative perspective and what was the negative side, I'll work through that as we come through the pension report here in just a minute on a more granular basis, but starting with some high-level data, and then we'll get more detailed. You see for the quarter of where we began at $172 million net cash flow, a little north of $2 million for the effectively the reimbursement back to effectively the county, meaning that the contributions between the county and members now are not as great as the benefit payments, right? The plan is maturing a little bit. Chiron's talked about that before, coupled with the fact that it's well-funded. So the county's contribution from, you know, trying to effectively extinguish that piece of the unfunded liability is reasonably small, because that unfunded liability isn't terribly large. From the performance summary, I have a couple comments around that in just a minute, but what I want to do as well is just highlight some of the changes during the quarter on this net cash flow column, which lists all the underlying investments. So from a cash flow perspective, it was largely around just at the margin, you know, trimming some, mostly equities as the market ramped higher to funnel funds into cash for that reimbursement and then replenish cash just a little bit as we move forward here. So you can see the first three non-dashed rows to the tune of about a little bit north of $1 million when we sum up everything going effectively into this money market fund and helping fund that reimbursement or that net cash outflow I spoke to earlier. And then the other large number you can see is here, Clarion Real Estate continues to wind down. This is the dividend being paid back to the money market and also the redemption being paid back. So at the end of June, it was around 3% of the pension. As we sit here this morning, it's closer to 2 to 2.5. So it continues to wind down and we'll ultimately get to where what was approved from a policy perspective, hopefully within the next, say, 2 to 3 quarters. Now, from a peer perspective, as always, you know, what we're looking at here is just an anonymized comparison, how the fund is doing relative to, you can see here, a population or a universe of other public defined benefit funds across the U.S. So you can see the respective sample sizes across each of these respective periods, you know, to the tune of 440 to 550. So a decent universe to draw some conclusions. And even though the fund was behind that policy index, it was just a smidge behind the median there. So these numbers in parentheses are the rankings where lower numbers are better and vice versa. So a little bit behind the median during the quarter. As you work away from left to right, you can see year to date comfortably better than it because of Q1, right? The downside protection in Q1 when those sort of high flyers and AI leaders were really under a lot of pressure when the market was declining. And as you continue to work away from left to right, kind of oscillating between that top quartile, top 40% over time. So comfortably better than the median in all periods. Now, what's interesting, and I think borne out by what we've seen on a relative basis in various market environments, this is the same sort of analysis, but from a standpoint of not just returns on the left, but the risk-adjusted returns, right? So in other words, this takes into account the volatility or the dispersion of those returns, right? And the lower that volatility, the better this number would look like, right? Think about it as, lower highs, but also higher lows. That peer universe comparison as well. And unlike the 3, 5, and 10, just from an absolute perspective, kind of around that top quartile, top 40, here we go, top 15, top 20, right? So the risk-adjusted returns have been pretty strong relative to the peer group. A lot of that goes to the asset allocation, the policy itself that the committee has informally approved and council ultimately approved over time, whether it be infrastructure more recently, bank loans more recently, the regional equity split over time has performed really well. And then as far as the implementations, right, the managers via upside participation or downside protection worked pretty well over the intermediate and long term. And then just to highlight some of the underlying investments before I get into just the July numbers quickly and then wrap up with some outlook comments. As I noted earlier, this delta or this difference here largely driven by the equity bucket itself. So total equities weighted average of U.S., non-U.S., global, about 60% of the portfolio. And you can see, 60% of 130 basis points is effectively this number, right? The 80 basis points. And you can see that within the U.S. was up almost 10%, but a little bit behind the broad market at 11, largely due to the allocation of small and mid-cap stocks down here. So Eaton Vance, a fund sub-advised by Atlantic Capital, more of a higher quality defensive growth type manager. they're not going to have a ton of exposure to those, quantum computing type stocks down in their neck of the woods. So that drove some of their underperformance. And then the Vanguard Small Cap Value Index, in line with its respective benchmark, as we would expect, but small cap value stocks underperformed the broad market in Q1. And then global equities, again, similar story. In essence, about 2 percentage points or a little bit more behind. Now, the managers themselves in aggregate within this bucket, you'd see in the gray rows, 3 out of 4, so everyone save Artisan was actually ahead of their respective benchmark. But MFS here, their low volatility global manager, their opportunity set, right? They're looking specifically for more conservative defensive names, steadier returns over time, is going to be underweight the types of names that did well in Q2. So in other words, when you put the pieces together, the opportunity set for these four managers is structurally underweight those types of names. So even though, again, 3 or 4 of them outperformed their respective benchmarks, that's what drove the slight underperformance when we put everything together relative to the global equity market. On the non-U.S. side, not too much to speak of there, more or less in line with the benchmark. Real estate, similar story, real estate, like I noted earlier, was up 1.5%, modestly ahead of its benchmark. You can see as a percentage of the portfolio at the end of the fiscal year was 2.5, lower than that as we sit here this morning because we got additional funds back in early July. Infrastructure via JP Morgan, you see, continues to perform pretty well on a consistent basis, up a little north of 2%. Bank loans, Aristotle, the manager we're using for this allocation, reasonable quarter, just modestly ahead of the benchmark there. And then fixed income, not too much to speak of here. You can see all the pieces put together roughly in line with the benchmark itself, the intermediate gov cred. So as far as the OPEB, I'll cover this very, very quickly since the underlying investments are the same. You can see where we began and where we ended up for the fiscal year there, a little north of $70 million. Similar story from the net cash outflow perspective. So we ended the quarter about $3.3 million higher than where we began. The returns are going to be pretty much on par with the pension because the underlying is effectively the same. There could be some vehicle differences, but the underlying managers are the same. And then from an activity perspective, as I noted earlier, for the pension, you know, pretty much the same in spirit. So in other words, trimming up some equities at the margin to funnel some of those cash requirements in addition to replenishing cash just a smidge. But you can see cash had obviously an outflow in aggregate here. And then finally, before I skip to July, from the peer perspective, from not just an absolute, but also a risk-adjusted perspective, the story is going to be the same. Now, you will note, if you remember, on the 10-year number, it's a little higher, or say a lower ranking for the pension. Always important just to remember that. The OPEB didn't have that allocation to the state pool a number of years ago, so that's still being caught in the relative differences between the two funds, but everything really, almost 5 years in, it's going to be right on top of each other. Now, before I hit July, which was largely the same as Q2, and talk a little bit about the outlook for the rest of this year, let me pause there quickly, see if there are any comments or questions before I finish up here in the next minute or so.
I have a question way back to the Fed. At the last Fed meeting, there was a lot of pressure from the administration to cut rates, and the Fed held the line. You said that the market is sort of pricing an 80% cut at the next Fed meeting. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts, even if they're just personal thoughts, on what, if any, pressure is coming from the administration versus the economy being ready for an interest rate cut. And at the same time, quarter point or half a point.
Yeah. So I don't think a half a point, unless we get a payroll report on, I believe it'd be September 5th, that is just a total disaster. A half a point is not on the table. I don't think anybody's thinking about that. As far as the say, economic conditions warranting a cut versus any pressure coming from the administration, I think the Fed, or at least a majority of those on the Fed, are you know, largely ignoring that to the extent that they can. So I don't think any pressure from the administration is going to play a role in what they may or may not do. In fact, on a personal level, I think it might be counterproductive to some degree, meaning that, you know, as people, right, you know, when you're told to do something, you're not doing your job well, you may subconsciously want to do the opposite. Now, I don't know that to be the case, and maybe that's just the cynic in me. but I think they'll largely rely on the economic conditions. It seems likely that they, obviously more likely than not, that they're going to cut. But if we get this inflation data before the meeting, and it's still, you know, comfortably higher than target, which it likely will be, but if it surprises to the upside, and the next labor report comes out and job growth is reasonable, say again in the 80,000 to 90,000 range, that we may not get that cut. And I know this is like a non-answer, but it's really speaking to that the macro environment right now is incredibly muddy based on all the tension of the inflation data versus the economic data. Now, just one last comment to your question around, you know, does the economy need it? You know, certain sectors of the economy certainly we think would need it, like the housing sector, manufacturing. But if you look at the economy as a whole, you can make a very easy case that the economy doesn't necessarily need it, particularly given the fact that credit spreads in various parts of the credit market are extremely tight, financial conditions are incredibly loose, that there's really no reason to do it, and they should save their ammo, if you will, for another time. But we'll see. There's another 4 weeks, and I think, again, the markets are pricing it in right now, but that could change.
Thank you.
Of course, of course. So with that said, I'll touch on July here quickly. And again, it was more of the same here. So you can see the total fund in July, and this is the same for the OPEB. So I won't touch on that. The numbers are spot on. It was up 0.6%. A little bit behind the policy again, largely coming from the equity bucket. It was the same story through Q2. So, you know, I won't run through every specific number here, but what I would say is a couple things. Number one, at the end of July, even though we trimmed some equities at the end of June to kind of help with the cash outflow and replenish the cash bucket, we did further trim equities towards the end of July. You can see running a modest underweight coming into August here, really for a couple of reasons. Number one, we've had such an amazing run over the past 3-4 months now. And number two, from a seasonal perspective, meaning that the market tends to exhibit a general pattern throughout the calendar year, and it doesn't always hold true, but it has followed the normal seasonal pattern this year, meaning that in Q1, we tend to start out well, have a little bit of a hiccup in early Q2, then we tend to rally through July. And now once we get into this period, sort of your August to October period, markets can be volatile or experience any, you know, volatility, a downdraft, a decent decline. And obviously the catalysts or the reasons are always obvious in hindsight. But this tends to be a weaker period for the market as a whole. So we did trim some exposures. Now, if we continue to follow this pattern, if we do see that, then the market typically finds a bottom in, say, early, mid-ish October and rallies through the end of this year. So we're a little bit underweight equities now for reasons I talked about in the market environment and those specific reasons. And if we do get that decent decline, say, and we're not talking anything that we saw earlier this year, maybe just something to the tune of, you know, 5-10%. Then we'll be looking maybe to rebalance back into equities in early October as we close out this year and likely get that Q4 rally if we continue this seasonal pattern here and reassess things at the end of this year into early next year. But at a high level, given reasons, you know, longer term, more structural reasons I talked about earlier, we're going to continue to be underweight those high flying names, because even though those valuations, again, as I talked to earlier, don't mean anything in the short term, they tend to leave areas that are more overvalued, more susceptible than they otherwise would have been. So in other words, again, when the markets had declines or volatility, it's been those areas that have underperformed because their valuations are typically more expensive. So if you are overvalued and there is some volatility or a drawdown, it's usually the names that led things to the way up that are more expensive that get hit the hardest on the way down. So in other words, you know, we do believe that maintaining this structure will leave us in essentially the same pattern of where we've been is participating on that upside. But if we do get poor environments, really protecting on that downside, again, the lower highs, but the higher lows. So with all that said, that wraps up my comments for this morning. But again, happy to answer any other questions or address any comments you all may have.
Okay, does anybody have any questions or comments for Mr. Wing? All right, hearing none, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Mr. Wing.
Of course, thank you all.
All right, the next item is additional business. Does anybody have anything that they want to address? Okay. I just want to remind everybody that our meeting in November will be in person. We do have our actuaries who will come in. They will present. Pat will also be there as well. So just as a reminder, November will be in person here in Georgetown. Okay. We are now going to adjourn. Can I have a motion to adjourn?
I'll motion.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. We are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone.